voice.
Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum, a series of talks and interviews with writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm John O'Brien. Our guest for this episode is the writer and musician James McBride. It would be great to say McBride doesn't need an introduction, since he won the National Book Award for Fiction in 2013. But partially due to the fact that he likes to keep a low profile, you may not have heard of him. Hopefully that's changing. McBride began his career as a musician, earning an undergraduate degree in music composition from Oberlin College in 1979. He went on to tour as a saxophonist with jazz legend Little Jimmy Scott. That's him we're hearing now. Later, as a composer, he won the American Pop Music Theater Festival's Stephen Sondheim Award for his jazz pop musical Bobos. McBride earned a master's degree in journalism from Columbia University and pursued a writing career with the Boston Globe, People magazine, and the Washington Post. He gained acclaim for his memoir, The Color of Water, a black man's tribute to his white mother. Then in 2013, he won the National Book Award for The Good Lord Bird. In it, McBride reimagines the story of the abolitionist John Brown, seen through the eyes of a young slave named Henry Onion Shackelford. The National Book Award judges called McBride's a voice as comic and original as any we have heard since Mark Twain. As you'll hear, McBride has something to say about that. As you listen to this episode, keep in mind that James McBride gave this talk without any notes. In it, he riffs on his family, career, books, and life in America with humorous, inspiring, and masterful improvisation. James McBride is currently a distinguished writer in residence at New York University. Seattle Arts and Lectures presented this talk at Town Hall Seattle on October 15, 2014. The presenting sponsor was the Seattle Times. Here's Seattle Arts and Lectures' Ruth Dickey to present this evening with James McBride.
I'd like to begin by thanking the many partners who have made tonight possible. Thanks to our presenting sponsor, the Seattle Times. Thanks to our organizational supporters, all of whom are listed in our program, and special thanks to for significant organizational support to 4Culture, Amazon.com, Arts Fund, Boeing, the Confidence Foundation, the Elizabeth George Foundation, Expedia, the Harvest Foundation, the Mannix Canby Foundation, the Medina Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Petunia Foundation, the Seattle Office of Arts and Culture, and the Washington State Arts Commission. I know, they deserve a round of applause. Thank heavens there are still funders who believe in the arts. Thanks to our media sponsors, City Arts, King FM, KUOW, KPLU, and Seattle Met. Thanks to Town Hall, our gracious host for this evening and the home for our entire literary arts series. Thanks to tonight's bookstore partner, Elliott Bay Book Company. I know. And thanks to tonight's gracious patron reception host, Marjorie, and fantastically talented chef, Donna Moody. Last but not least, thank you to all of you for being here with us tonight. It is truly this community of people who care about books and care about writing that makes Seattle special and that make this work possible. So thank you for being here. You deserve applause too. The format for this evening will be remarks by Mr. McBride, whom I will then join on stage for a lively conversation. I will include as many of your questions as possible, so if you have a question for Mr. McBride, please write it on a question card and pass it to an usher. If you would like to tweet, Facebook, or otherwise post about tonight's event, we would be most grateful. Our handle is CArtsLectures, and our hashtag for tonight is SalMcBride. After the questions, Mr. McBride will sign books here, and you can get your copy or copies right here. If you were one of the first lucky 200 people to subscribe to the Literary Arts Series, you won a free signed copy of the book, and you would have gotten a ticket that said book ticket with your book or with your tickets for the series. And our intrepid friends downstairs reminded me a lot of you have not yet picked up your book. So if you are a lucky winner, please be sure to pick up your book before you leave tonight. To officially open our evening, I'm proud to introduce a student from our Writers in the Schools program. This year, Writers in the Schools will work in 23 area schools and at Seattle Children's Hospital to pair them with professional, local, creative writers for year-long residencies, where they will inspire and engage students to craft their own poems, stories, and memoirs. Tonight's reader, Gavin Mountree, worked with WITS writer-in-residence Karen Finifrock last year as a fifth grader at Lafayette Elementary School, and he just wowed me at the celebrations for the publication of our new student anthology, The Sixth Breath Blows You Home. Speaking of which, you can pick up your very own copy in the lobby after the event for a very modest donation. Please join me in welcoming Gavin, who will be reading his poem, Water as Power.
Water as power. I waited till everybody was gone to do what every kid wanted to do. I opened a path through the ocean, walked through as I let the water down behind me. Played with the small water tornado as I went. When I got home, I flooded everything I touched.
Thank you so much, Gavin. And now, the moment we have been eagerly awaiting, it's my honor to introduce to you James McBride. If you had told me that I would read a funny book about slavery and John Brown's raid at Harper's Ferry, I would have told you that you were absolutely crazy. But James McBride's The Good Lord Bird is more than a funny book about slavery. It's a fascinating take on history, narrated by Little Onion, a runaway slave, Henry, passing as a girl. Onion's voice is funny, irreverent, captivating, and surprising. It feels fresh and contemporary, and it illuminates abolitionist John Brown, Harriet Tubman, and even Frederick Douglass in unexpected ways. James McBride's writing career has illuminated many things in unexpected ways. From the Buffalo Soldiers of World War II, to slavery, to his own childhood, McBride's gift for storytelling has brought life, humor, and humanity to stories both universal and personal. The incredibly talented McBride has won acclaim as both a writer and a musician. He's a professional jazz musician, having toured as a saxophonist and composed for renowned musicians like Anita Baker and Grover Washington. He also holds a master's in journalism from Columbia and has written for the Washington Post, the New York Times, Essence, Rolling Stone, National Geographic, and the Boston Globe, among others. He's the author of four bestsellers, including his memoir, The Color of Water, which was on the New York Times bestseller list for over 2 years, Miracle at St. Anna, Song Yet Unsung, and The Good Lord Bird, which won last year's National Book Award. McBride is a distinguished writer in residence at NYU, and the New York Times has compared him to Mark Twain, calling The Good Lord Bird a brilliant romp of a novel that evokes sheer glee with every page, and said, McBride sanctifies by humanizing, a larger-than-life warrior lands, warts, foibles, absurdities and all, right here on earth. Indeed, at the very end of The Good Lord Bird, and this isn't ruining anything if you haven't read it, when Onion visits John Brown for the last time, Brown says to him, whatever you is, Onion, be it full. God is no respecter of persons. And I believe that this is the great gift McBride gives to his characters in each of his books, to his mother in The Color of Water, to his readers, to all of us, to truly see, warts and all, to honor and celebrate a world of unexpected humor, of characters capable of simultaneous heroism and cowardice, brutality and benevolence, a world where we might all hope to find courage, to be whatever we are, to be it in full. Please join me in warmly welcoming the brilliant, funny, insightful, illuminating James McBride.
Thank boom, 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 poof, boom. Well, thank you very much. I really, very nice to see so many white, nice people here today, really. And Gavin was fantastic. When I was 11, I couldn't tie my shoes, and this kid is already writing. We're just going to tie his hands so there won't be any competition for me later on when he gets older. I don't have any prepared remarks. Everything that Ruth said made me feel like a fraud, really, when I hear that kind of talk, you know, because I don't really, in a lot of ways, I don't really know what I'm doing, but it's okay. But I would like to thank Ruth for being such a great host today. She was very patient with me. Thank you and the Arts League and especially Rick and Elliott Bay Books. One of the reasons why I'm here, actually, is because of Elliott Bay Books. Because when The Color of Water first came out, The Color of Water was sold, hand-sold, by independent booksellers. And Elliott Bay was one of those principal booksellers that made The Color of Water a success. In addition to the Jewish women who, you know, the young ones aged 20 to 80 who read. And so I'm very grateful to Elliott Bay. And I just would like to remind you that independent bookstores are really the last line of reason and discourse in this country. So when you buy my book, make sure you know, really. I hope you continue to support Elliott Bay, and I hope you continue to support independent bookstores everywhere you go. It's really, really important. Okay, that said, I thought I would open the night by reading for about 40 minutes and then having a Q&A at the end. And, you know, after that, we'd have a little coffee clatch and go clogging together here in Seattle, where there's a lot of traffic and no subway, you know. Well, I was walking around today, you know, I didn't get a chance really to talk to too many people, but I walked around a little bit and I went to St. James Cathedral, which was really, really nice, really amazing. And I went inside and the door was open and the organist was playing and it was really wonderful. It was a wonderful, peaceful time. I'm comfortable in church because I grew up in church. For those of you who haven't read The Color of Water, the two of you, the two Gentiles in here who lived in Saudi Arabia and didn't get the news, I was born in Brooklyn, New York, thank you. Yeah, that's right. Well, before Brooklyn became Portland, I was born in Brooklyn, New York. And my mother was she was a very strange person. You know, she was a person who walked around the black neighborhood like it wasn't a big deal. As a kid, as I write in The Color of Water, I was just, you know, flummoxed by the fact that that my mother was the only white person, like, in sight. You know, I can remember when I was a teenager. You know, I'd be playing basketball in the park. You know, I'd be Cunningham Park. This is in St. Albans, Queens. I'd be playing basketball, and my friend Country, he said to me, James, your mother's coming. I said, no, she's not. I said, because I said to myself, please, Lord, not with, you know, Sugar Bear and Poogie Bear and all the guys here, please. And I said, no, she's not coming. And then I saw in the distance, like, this little white lady stomping like this, and she said, get over here. I was like, oh, my God. And she did that basically all my life, you know. Only when I was a student at Oberlin, I know there's some Oberlin graduates here. I'm very glad to see you, and you know, very happy that I had the opportunity to go to Oberlin. I had to fill out a form or something that required. Well, I should back up by saying that I'm a product of the New York City public school system, and. And while I'm not against charter schools, I'm against charter schools. And I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. Because my family was successful in large part because of my mother and my father and my stepfather, and because we were religious and we had God in our lives. But also we were successful because the system really worked for us. She made it work, but it worked. We were successful because of the cops, because of civil servants workers, because of transit workers, because of teachers, because of social workers who did the job. So, you know, I still believe in the public schools. I was at Garfield High School today, and that was an amazing school. Of course, the public schools have problems, and I agree that that teachers need help and that the parents aren't doing the job. But ultimately, the older I get, the more I realize that as our society splits into two parts, that some of us have to say what really needs to be said. I mean, I'm not the guy. I'm not a politician. But the fact is, the public schools and public school teachers, they do the job. They do the job. The parents are the ones who oftentimes are not doing the job. And so I just wanted to, you know, lay that one on you. So, you know, in any case, when I was at school, I had to fill out some kind of form or something that required my mother's maiden name. And I called her, like, you know, collect, you know. And I said, hey, Mom, you know, what's your maiden name? And she said, blah, 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 you know, Shilsky, and hung up. And, you know, that just didn't sound like Jackson or, you know, Washington, you know. And so I knew as a child that my mother, she couldn't have been black. I mean, I had many friends. I had several friends who had mothers who were very light-skinned. In fact, my best friend, Billy Smith, his mother was, she looked like a white woman, but you could tell she wasn't. Mommy kind of had that pallor on her, but there was something else there. In any case, I became, you know, more and more curious about it as the years passed. And then after I quit the Washington Post, I moved back to New York and started playing jazz full time. And during that time, I wrote The Color of Water. I wrote The Color of Water in vans and in buses and, you know, while I was traveling with other musicians. And I never told anybody what I was doing because you just don't do that, you know. One interesting story is when I was with Little Jimmy Scott's band. Little Jimmy Scott just died recently, not long. Little Jimmy Scott was actually, like, his claim to fame, if you haven't heard Little Jimmy Scott, and you ought to hear his records because he's an extraordinary cat, his thyroid never developed. Like, you know, something about him, like, his thyroid never developed, so he sounded like a woman. Like, if you hear Nancy Wilson, she'll tell you, I learned everything I know from Jimmy Scott. And so we were playing in Philly one time, and he had a phenomenal voice. I mean, he had this plaintive sort of sound, and he sang with his arms out like that. And so we went to Philly, we were playing in Philly once, and my brother Richie was in the audience, and, you know, we were hitting, and Jimmy was singing. And afterwards, Richie, isn't, you know, and Richie was like the jazz guru in my house. He was like, you know, Coltrane, Miles, he would just nod and walk around. He didn't do anything, just nod and walk and shoot birds with his BB gun, you know, and then he would nod more. So, but since he was the guru of my jazz life as a child, I really wanted to know what his opinion of Jimmy Scott was. That really meant a lot to me. And so I said, what do you think, man? Afterwards, you know, he said, I like, I said, how did Jimmy sound? He said, she sounded great. I said, no, Richie, Jimmy's a man. He said, no, he said, that's a girl, man. That's a straight out 110% girl. So I said, no. He said, well, let me ask you, have you ever seen him, like, go to the bathroom? And I said, no, I have not. I have not seen him. I did not look, but I did not see him go to the bathroom. So we were leaving Philly and driving to play Boston, you know. And we were driving up the road in one of those vans with has the TV and all that stuff in. And Jimmy said to the driver, he said, pull over, baby, pull over. I got to go to the bathroom. So the guy pulled over. And you know, on the East Coast, like when you go to the bathroom, like when you pull over at a rest stop, you know, they give you that key. I mean, it's on like a wooden block. You don't even want to touch the thing. You know, they give you the key, you know. So Jimmy went and got the key. And I had this, I said, I'm going to watch him go to the, because now I started thinking, well, you know. So I followed him around, and he went to the bathroom, and he shut the door before I could go in there, you know. So I said, how about that? So we went to Boston, and then we were coming back from Boston to New York, and then we went to another rest stop, like a big rest stop where you could like see everything. And I followed him in, and I can tell you that while his thyroid had never developed, the cat had been married four times. I mean, I got it. I was like, whoa. So how did I get to talking about that story? I know. So I was in Jimmy's band, and we were flying to, and I was researching Color Water, and we were in Jimmy's band, and we were going to Montreal to open up for Rosemary Clooney, who was still alive at the time, and playing a festival up there, and the plane couldn't land because it was a storm. And there was a little Hasidic Jewish boy sitting right across the aisle from me. He had the little payas, the little braids. He was by himself, you know, and it was this empty seat in him and me. And I was sitting with the four cats in the band, you know, the bass drummer, the pianist, and bass drummer, piano, myself. And Jimmy was up in first class. And so the boy, they couldn't land the plane, so they decided to feed everybody. Because we were circling, and they tried to feed the kid, and he wouldn't eat. And my newfound knowledge of kosher Jewish life, I told the flight attendant, I said, don't feed him. I said, he's, you know, just give him a glass of water. So she gave him a glass of water, and the kid took the water and did one of these. You know, he like smiled at me, and I kind of got it. You know, it's like his mother obviously told him, don't talk to strangers, and, you know, and so forth. So it was cool, but one of the guys made a crack about the kid. And we got into an argument, and we argued all the way until we got to customs. And when we got to customs, they pulled us out of line. So when we got to the date, by the time we got to the venue, we were in our street clothes. In Jimmy's band, you wore a tux, bow tie, and we were still in our street clothes, warming up while people were coming in. Now, while this argument broke out between me and the musician that cracked on the kid, nobody in the band knew what I was doing. I didn't tell them that I was writing a book about my mother, and I had researched anti-Semitism in the South, and I had become sensitized. I didn't. And the guy who ran the band, his name was Hill Green. He hired people. He was the straw boss. He was a bass player. And when this argument broke out on the plane, Hill was right next to me, and he didn't say a word. Hill's a tall black guy. He's got real dark skin. He's got a beautiful face, you know. And he didn't say a word, you know. But I looked at him and I said, when I was warming up, I remembered that he was just pissed off about the whole thing. I said, you know what? He's going to fire me. Because, you know, I just got into such a virulent argument over what was just, you know, apparently probably to him, nothing. And shortly after I was thinking that, he leaned over. He was holding his bass, and he leaned over to me. And he said, you know what, James? He said, that joke that they said about the kid, he said, that wasn't funny to me neither. And then he leaned back, and he kept warming up. And I say that to say that it's easy, you know, particularly here in Seattle, to say, you know, let's start a committee and, you know, let's discuss this. Let's have a committee to talk about, you know, let's make it easy for queer people and let's, you know, Martin Luther King's Day, let's all cry crocodile tears. Let's, you know, let's rah, rah. It's easy to say that. But when you do it within the framework and the cone of your own existence, when you do it when your job is dependent on it, when your life is involved, when your mortgage is involved, when your whole... When the people in your circle are involved, when you speak out then, when you do it then for real, when you write a check, when you show up at an independent bookstore instead of just hitting send button, then you inch the collective good forward just a little bit more. It really happens with you individually. And that's really something that I keep in mind as I course through my life, because I used to see that my mother had a great moral dilemma when she was a young mother. She had to decide how to raise her children. And the choices were not great. This was before the whole business of being mixed was. I mean, I wouldn't say it's acceptable now, but it was a lot easier. And so she did the smart thing. She just said, you're black. When they see you, they're not going to see a sign on your forehead saying, you know, you're something else. You're black. And you have to live with that. Now, you'd be the best you can, and I don't want to hear any excuses. I'm not interested in you coming home saying the white man's holding you back. Where is he at? Where's he at? Where's he at? He's holding you back. Where? She didn't want to hear it. And then when she got mad, she had a belt that was thunder and lightning. You know something? If the social services had come into my house when I was growing up, I'd be speaking Spanish right now. Because they would have cleaned, they'd have taken us all out. But, and she did some, I mean, she did some wrong things too. She wasn't perfect. But in any case, after I wrote The Color of Water and it came out, I went to her house and first of all, I gave one to my local bookstore, and he didn't even read it, to be honest with you, but he didn't understand, you know. But and I should say that when The Color of Water was first a manuscript, it was rejected by several publishers. Shall I name them? I shall not. But in any case, after it was published, I gave one to my local bookstore. And I drove down to my mother's house. I lived in Brooklyn at the time, and my mother lived near Trenton, New Jersey. And I drove, you know, when you drive from Brooklyn to Trenton, you stop in every 8 feet to pay a toll. You're driving on the Verrazano Bridge, 1350, and you go to New Jersey Turnpike, they knock you down for another 75, and you just, Route 1, you're sitting there, and you get there, and you come out. I gave her the book. I said, Ma, here's the book. She was sitting in the living room. I gave her the book. I got back in my car, drove on Route 1, stops, lights, Verrazano Bridge, 1350. It got back to Brooklyn, and I called back to see what was happening. And my sister Kathy picked up the phone. And I said, Kathy, what's going on? She said, don't call back. Mommy's been in her bedroom all day. Don't call back. Boom. So I waited a day, and I called the second time. I said, what's going on? She said, Mommy came out of her bedroom for some coffee. She's back in there crying. Don't call back. Boom. I called again the next day, and she said, Mommy came out of her bedroom. She's okay. I drove down. I drove over the Verrazano Bridge, down Route 1, paid another toll, you know, $13.50, $0.85. Okay, I got there, and Mommy was sitting in the living room on the couch, and I said, Mom, what do you think? You know, 14 years, you know, me and you, book, what do you think? And she said, it's okay. So you can see the Deepak Chopra of the moment was just powerfully moving her. But I think what she was afraid of was that that her kids would not like her or love her or respect her after reading her story, and when in fact we loved her and respected her even more. And I've as a result of that book, I've met many of my Jewish relatives. I still haven't gotten over the fact that when I get stopped by the police at 2 o'clock in the morning, they don't know who I am. You know, I said, you know, put the gun away. My mom's Jewish, really. It's okay. Just back down, sir. Don't, sir, I'm going to write a letter to the New York Times. Just get over there. No, what happened was my brother Billy passed away, but when he was alive at the time, he was a doctor. And he got a call from a guy who said he was a cousin, and he was a doctor. You know, so they called each other doctor to doctor. You know, I bet you they billed each other, you know. And he said, you know, we have a cousin. His name is Ken. He called me from Texas. And he's, you know, mommy's sister's son. He's our cousin. He wants to meet us. So, I called the guy and I said, all right, well, you know. And he said, I'm coming to New York on business. I'm so excited to meet you and all this. So I said, okay, well, let's do it, you know. And so I said, what do you look like? He said, I'm a short, dark Jewish guy. Well, I, there's only like three of them in New York completely. So I was standing in an out, you know, in Newark, and those times you could actually stand at the airport and wait for people to come out. And I was standing at the end of the alleyway waiting for, like, trying to shake the hand of every short, dark Jewish guy. There were hundreds of them. And I was like, oh, no, I'm not going to rob you. It's okay. And so finally this guy shows up, and it was him. And it was a delight to meet him, and I took him to Mommy's. And I took him, he was supposed to do something in New York. He was so excited, he said, I want to meet my aunt right now. And I drove him to Mommy's house. And you know, Mommy's house was in full effect. My mother's house was always like a train station. There were always people stopping through who were, you know, just looked like. I mean, my sister's boyfriend at the time he had a Rastafarian thing going on. And he had a whole bunch of keys. I mean, he had like belts full of keys, and he opened the door, and I said, that's it. But Ken was real cool about it, and then we ended up, you know, becoming close, and I did an event in Texas once with, you know, the Barbara Bush Literacy Foundation, and he came, and him and his wife came with me, and this is the thing. They had like a wine and cheese, and you're like meeting the people, and these are all these Texas cats with these big 10-gallon hats, and they, And I said, my name is James Bryden, this is my cousin Ken, and these cats were like this, like boing, you know, they couldn't deal with it. They were like, oh, ew. oh, yeehaw. But they got over it, you know. And I wondered, I said to him, how do you make it down here? You know, I mean, you know, Jewish guy in Texas, he said, we all stick together down here. We all live in the same neighborhood, you know, we all know each other. And he still lives in Texas, and he loves Texas. He has boots and all that stuff. I mean, he's all in it, you know. I mean, I'm proud of my Jewish relatives. We don't all get along. Some of my siblings are not that interested in my Jewish relatives, and some of my Jewish relatives, frankly, are not interested in my side of the family. But those of us who are. And when my mother died in January 2010, we got a lot of attention from our Jewish relatives, including her sister, who died last October. And when she died, many of us attended her service. And it was very sad when her sister died because it was the end of the era. They don't make that generation of Jewish women anymore. That generation of Jewish people are gone forever. And a lot dies with them. A lot dies when an old person dies. And that's, you know, that's how it was. When my mother passed away, she died at home. She was 88. And she was planning to see, what's that movie with the cartoon characters, the James Cameron movie with the big green people? Avatar. Yeah, she was planning to see Avatar the week she died. That's how much she just could function. Her heart basically just stopped, you know. She had open heart surgery when she was in her early 70s, and they mentioned it again. She said, no, I don't want to do that, you know. That hurts, you know. She just was, you know, she was ready to go home. And what happened was when she started to pass, she knew at a certain point she just, you know, she knew she was dying, and it was really hard, you know. She said, at one point she said to me and my sister, she said, am I dying? And I said to her, I said, yes, Ma. I said, you're going to Jesus. Now you're going home. Jesus is waiting. He's right on the other side. What are you waiting? Go. You're going. Just going home to Jesus. And that kind of perked her up. Then she got into the thing, well, where's Hunter? You know, because my little brother's supposed to be there. So she actually waited 6 hours for my brother Hunter, who had just gotten married. He got married the 5th. She died the 10th. He had just flown to Puerto Rico for his wedding honeymoon. And she waited until he got home at 2 in the morning. Actually, she sat up and was alive for 6 hours watching TV. And then she laid back down. Hunter came. She saw him. And then she died. And as you can imagine, it was very, very difficult. My mother is buried in North Carolina next to my father, Andrew McBride. She's the only white person in the cemetery. Because when my father and his parents were buried, they were all buried in a colored cemetery in Green in the High Point, and they had one more spot, and they don't allow people to bury unless you had a spot there from years ago. They wouldn't allow you, but they had one more spot, so she was buried there. So even into death, she's just kicking ass and taking names. And that same year, my niece died 2 weeks later, and then 3 or 4 months later, my now ex-wife divorced me. So it was a difficult year, and so I spun into orbit, you know. And those of you who've been the two of you who've been divorced here kind of understand that. Of course, you know, they don't divorce in Seattle because it's, you know, Tom Hanks makes movies here and stuff, but. You know, I was just it was like someone rolled a grenade under the door and pulled the pin and walked away, and I ended up sleeping on my futon in New York for a good 2 years, during that time, the good Lord Bird was born. What happened was I was in Maryland researching previous to my divorce. I was in Maryland researching the book Song Yet Sung, which was my third book, which 8 people read. And I have 11 brothers and sisters, so you know. It's, oh, 9. It's 9. God bless you, sir. St. James. Anyway, I was in the Frederick, Maryland Historical Society. And they had, you know, these books. And I was just going through. And there was a two-volume diary of a Jewish merchant who worked in Frederick. And it was very interesting. I mean, if you want to read really interesting accounts of American life, you read about what some Jewish people went through during those years. Like Rabbi David Einhorn in Baltimore, for example, his house burnt down. He just spoke out against slavery, so they just burned him out of town and sent him north. And then he started the Reform Jewish movement in America. So in any case, I was fishing, you know, and I started reading these big vibes, and he'd write like September 9th, you know, Jane Eisner came in for, you know, da-da-da-da, she bought a pound of potatoes, September 10th, Joe Solomon came by and his daughter has a fever, September 15th, John Smith came by and he dropped off a mule, and then he got to October 20th and he wrote, John Brown raided Harper's Ferry, and then there was this long, long discourse about what had happened at Harper's Ferry that he had heard about and read about. So I just said, let me just check this out. So I drove my car down to Harper's Ferry and took a look around, and I said, this is a good story, but how can I tell it? And then I forgot about it because, you know, mommy passed away, and then my niece Jay passed away, and then I was divorced, and I was broke, and, you know, then, you know, things happen. But this voice that I had heard many years before, many years ago, I wrote a story about a short story that was so horrible, I can't even tell you what it was about, but it was pretty bad. But the voice in it was good. I liked the voice. I was working at People Magazine at the time. I was covering Michael Jackson. I was like, I covered Michael Jackson during his big, you know, victory, like Thriller tour, when he was at the top of his game. And I covered him exclusively for 6 months. By the way, I never thought Michael did any of those nasty things that they said he did. But you know, the Jacksons didn't like me that much. They thought I was an Uncle Tom because they'd never seen a black reporter from People Magazine before. And my job wasn't to be their publicist. I had to be a reporter, even though it was People Magazine. I mean, I still had to, you know, I had to have some shred of integrity. I mean, you know, some slice of integrity, you know. So we really didn't get along that well. But at a certain point, after a few months, they respected me and they were respectful toward me. I can't say they liked me, but they were respectful because my stories were always accurate. And there was a lot of stuff that I saw that I didn't write, that I could, you know, like people love those little nasty little tidbits like, you know, oh, Michael did a number two and then you came in the bathroom afterward and smelled bad. Oh, okay, well, great. That's just, oh, what a story. I mean, oh, why didn't you, why, that's a headline. I mean, so I didn't know. So I just basically ignored a lot of that stuff and just stuck with the facts of the tour and the musicality. I mean, he was extremely gifted. You know, my next book is about James Brown. And him and Michael Jackson had a lot in common in the sense that when they rehearsed the band, they were neither was a trained musician, but the precision and the demands that they placed on their musicians were extraordinary. And I saw Michael rehearse for months. Well, I'd say about 6 weeks. And he was just absolutely insane in terms of his meticulousness, in terms of putting his music together. And anyway, during that period, I was writing. I would get up in the morning, like I do now, and I would write. And I wrote a short story that it was awful. It was about a lion in a zoo in Washington, D.C. I just thought it was the most charming thing in the world. But I gave it to an agent, and she said, "This ain't working, son," you know. But the voice in it was good. And I always kept that voice in my head. And so spin forward 30 years later, or maybe 25 years later, you know, I'm laying on my pallet in Manhattan feeling sorry for myself, you know, watching the yuppies pick up this pooper scooper on 43rd Street because it's the new 43rd Street, you know. I just want to say one thing about gentrification. Just let me mention this to you. When I first came to 43rd Street in 1990, or 1989, you know, you had to run to get to the apartment. And, you know, it was loud, and it's Tony! And, you know, pit bulls in the place, and people were smoking weed and crack, and the prostitutes, you knew the pimps and the prostitutes. They didn't bother you as long as you didn't bother them. And you always walked into Miller Street at night, and there was never a lot of traffic, and you could always find a place to park, and it didn't smell bad. Now, if you roll down 43rd Street, you know, don't light a cigarette because, oh, you can, oh, the secondhand smoke. Meanwhile, Fifi and Fufu and Yaya and these giant dogs, they're and all that smells like, it smells like dog urine. Almost, because everybody's got a dog. And they don't pick up, or if they pick up and they're walking around the little dog poopy in the thing. And, you know, I just hate it. I can't stand it. I just think they should all go away. Really, I just, in the old days, I was scared for my life, and now I wouldn't be caught dead there. It's just, and I know it's really me, and it's not my new neighbors. And they move in the building, and they look at the Wall Street Journal, and they look at you, and they like want to know what you're doing there, you know. But anyway, what was I talking about? I forgot. Oh, the voice, yes, the voice of God. You know, it's funny when football players make a touchdown, they say, you know, how did you do it? And he goes, oh, well, I want to thank God, the Lord Jesus Christ. I'm like, dude, really, just can we get to the, you know. Anyway, I had this voice in my mind, and I needed to find a place for it. And when I was sitting around 43rd Street trying to figure out, you know, looking out the window, feeling sorry for myself, you know, oh, woe is me and so forth, that voice kept coming back to me, and I said, I've got to find a place for it. And I started thinking about the John Brown business, and I started driving down to Harper's Ferry. And the more I went to Harper's Ferry, the more the story became real to me. And that's how this book was born. And it got to the point where, and the reason why, by the way, the Onion, the protagonist in the Good Lord Bird is really just, it's a boy who John Brown kidnaps or frees, but he thinks the boy's a girl, and the boy is so scared of John Brown, he just says, I'll play along because this white man's crazy and I'll just act like a girl. So he plays as a girl throughout the entire book. And the reason why he does that is because I just didn't feel qualified to write from a girl's perspective. I just didn't feel like I could do it. And also, I had this voice in my head, and I thought the voice would be effective. And so it became a relief to me to sit down and just dive into the world of Onion Shackelford and to show the world what a crazy, outrageously, superbly idiotic, wonderful coot old John Brown was. And so it worked out. And, you know, today I did a TV show here. I don't remember the name of it, but, it, you know, you'll see it. It's on PBS, so, you know, that means, like, you'll probably be the only ones that watch it, but but it's a TV show that everybody who comes to this series does. So I can't remember the name of the show, but I'm sure you will see it. And he asked me, he said, was this book, you know, the book that you always wanted to write? And the answer is yes. Yes, look, The Color of Water was just like, I had to do it because I had to live. And if I had known how many people were going to read that book, I swear to God, I'd have written a better book. But I was a young man at the time, and I had to get that out. But this was the creative book that I had always wanted to do. And I'm so glad that I got it done. So it was a blessing. My mommy's death was extremely difficult, and the ensuing events were hard. But you know, evolution, you evolve, you change, you forgive, you move on. And this book was God's gift to me for not, I guess, for just giving my ex-wife all my money. I don't know. But can I take that back? When you edit this, when you edit it for radio, I would really appreciate it if you, but in any case, so that's what happened. And when it won the National Book Award, and I told this to my agent, and she will verify this, when I heard it won the National Book Award, to be honest with you, I really didn't know what that meant because I had never really paid attention to it. I never really pay attention to that kind of thing. I don't really socialize with other writers. The only people I know are musicians who are broke and people in Brooklyn. And I don't really, I don't do a lot of writer's things, whatever that is. I just don't socialize with the New York writing community. I don't write for the magazine. I don't do magazine pieces and express my opinions about things because I don't really feel like I know that much. And so I was kind of an outsider to the game. And the judges for the National Book Award turned out to be, one of those judges was Rick Simonson here from the LA Bay books. And they had decided, apparently, to involve bookstore owners and writers as judges. I think they just changed the judging thing so that, you know, and I just happened to be standing there when God coughed, and I had the handkerchief. And I was walking out. I was literally at the awards thing ceremony. I was with my daughter. I had my little rented tux on, you know, and they announced the finalists. And, you know, they do the whole, it's like a Hollywood thing. You know, they got the, ba-da-da-da, but it's a tape, though, you know, ba-da-da-da-da. And then they show the books on a big screen, and the guy with the tux is, you know, and I told my daughter, and they feed you this, right, really, you know, expensive food. You get like a little bit and all that. So I told my daughter, I said, look, when they were serving the apple tart, I said, all right, hurry up, eat, because we're getting out. Because they, you know, they wait for the fiction for last. And so when they announced that the good Lord Bird actually won, I walked up there holding my napkin in my hand. I didn't even have a speech, you know, I'm luckily they didn't get me when I was coming out the bathroom with, like, you know, toilet paper on my shoe, you know, like limping, you know, oh. And it was nice, and it was a great moment for me professionally. But I took the trophy and I took that dough, that 10 grand, and I went in my car and I went home. And the next day, I went to see my friend Steve, who runs a junkyard, and I helped him pull a Toyota and listen to this. Steve has this big truck, right, that has these, you know, it has these, you know, that those lights that go. And so I said to him, I said, Steve, look, I won the National Book Award. He said, oh, yeah, that's cool. Hey, listen, did you know the Yankees with that? And I was like, hey, man. So he got a call that they had to get a car towed out of some lady had a car stuck in the mud and he needed to. So he said, you want to go for, you know, I said, yeah, because I had never done that before. So we got in the truck and I turned on the lights and, you know, and so we went to tow this lady out, and she was a Mexican woman. She didn't speak English that well, and she had a Toyota Prius. And so Steve went to he was trying to hook the hooks underneath the car. And, you know, the underneath those new cars, it's not quite, you can't quite grab stuff because it's all, you know, where's the axle? There's so many, you know, so many parts down there. So he said, go to the other side and see if you can hook. And so I went to the other side, and the lady was in the car. And, you know, those cars are silent, you know. And I don't know if she took her foot off the brake or what, but the car moved a little bit. And I said to myself, as the car moved, I heard Steve say, wait. And I said to myself, I just won the National Book Award, and I'm going to die right now. This is not good. But anyway, we got the car hooked up, and then we got on the back of the truck, and we went back. And so I don't pay too much attention to it. I don't know who's this year's finalists are. I'm sure they're very good. I never look to the side. I always look to where I have to go. When I was talking today to the newspaper, to the people at the Seattle newspaper, and it was wonderful to talk to some fellow journalists. And I was telling them that when I was working at the Washington Post, that was my last job, I was in the style section, I used to feel that everybody was smarter than me. And what I used to do was, and I still do it, I used to just make it look easy. I would come into, we would all work till 6 o'clock, and everybody said, okay, good night, take care, all right, ta-ta, toodaloo, ta-ta, and I would cut out. And then I'd come back at 9 and work all the way till 1 or 2 in the morning. Then I'd go home and go to sleep. And then I'd come back at 10 and I'd work for a half hour and I'd say, okay, it's done. And they'd say, oh, you're just a natural. It's just so easy. And because one of the things I learned from my mother was that, because she was a very unique person, was that there's always somebody who's going to be, you know, better, and smarter, whiter, blacker, cooler, have more money, and, you know, slimmer, blonde hair. They got more stuff than you, but no one can be you better than you, and no one can outwork you. And so I always have had that mentality. I always work harder than the other person. I lived in Fort Greene. When I left the Post, I moved to Brooklyn, to Fort Greene. That's when, you know, Fort Greene, Brooklyn was like it was the center of it was like the Harlem Renaissance. You know, Wynton Marcellus lived down the street, and Spike Lee lived on the next block, and Terrence Blanchard was there, and Talani Davis, and all these writers and filmmakers. And, you know, they did a big film about it. I was just talking to somebody about this, and they said, how come you weren't in that film? And I said, you know why? Because I never talked to any of those people. I was too busy working. I never went to parties or anything like that. I didn't want to meet them. You know, and I don't have time to talk to them. I got to do my work. And so I'm still that way. I just do the job. And it's been a blessing to come, you know, this far to this level, where people actually think that I, you, like, know what I'm talking about, you know. It's a nice place to be. In any case, have I hit 50 minutes yet? Because if you ask me questions, I can definitely, like, do better. Excuse me? I got 3 minutes? Okay. Well, let's see. I'm not that interesting, and I don't know what else to say about myself anymore. I met a famous writer. I don't want to say her name, but I did meet her one time, and then I met her again, and she didn't even talk to me. And, Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I run a program in Red Hook now, in my church, a music program, and I'm really excited about it. I'm more excited about that than anything else. It's just a music program, and I teach kids music on Thursday nights. And it's really, I'm not saying it to ask for money or solicit sympathy. I'm just saying I've reached the point in my life where I'm starting to do things that I really want to do. And it's really nice to be able, it's a blessing to live long enough to, my mother was always worried that the church would not survive. And so I started this program, and I really love it. I just love it. I dream about it all the time. I used to dream about other things, and now I just dream about that. And it's nice to live long enough to give back to the community that created you. I remember the people that helped us in Red Hook. I remember the people who helped me throughout the course of my life. I remember Dr. Silverman, who was a Jewish guidance counselor at Cardozo High School in Queens, and they used to send me to him when I was cutting school. And he, right behind Mr. Silverman, you could see everybody who was in front of the school smoking weed and drinking beer. And they put me in a class of truants, so that meant we all taught each other how to steal and rob and do things together, you know. And but they would, once a week, they would send us to Mr. Silverman. And I remember sitting in Mr. Silverman, so I had to go, and once a week, he'd say, you know, you have so much talent, you're so smart. And I would be like this. And one day he was trying to reach me, he was trying to talk to me, and I wouldn't, you know, I was just, and then he just pushed his chair back, and he said, okay, that's it. He said, that's it. He said, if you want to go out there and smoke that pot, and you want to make a fool of yourself and ruin your life, go ahead, go on and do it, go. He said, but it's a damn shame. And you know something? When he said that, like a light went off. It was like, wow, this guy like really cares about me. And I didn't stop smoking weed at that point, actually. But it was the beginning of a regenerative process. And I gradually began to change my behavior. And you might want to keep that in mind with your own kids and your grandkids, that it takes time to change the behavior, and that you have to be consistent. You know, my mother was always consistent. As a father, I try to be consistent. And the only other thing I'd like to share with you is that when I went to Oberlin, and I know there's some Oberlin people here, some of them remember Professor Wendell Logan, he was a black professor there, and when I was at Oberlin, they were really down on jazz. Now, I'll say this now, I love Oberlin. I'm deeply grateful to the school, and they have a great jazz department, but when I was there, they were really down on jazz. And if you were playing jazz, if you were practicing in the orchestra room or anywhere, the third violinist or the fourth cellist from the orchestra could come in and they'd say, I want that room. And you had to pack your equipment up and you had to get out. And that was just how it was. And it was one of the most embarrassing features of the school. They would talk about how Dave Brubeck came there in 1954 and blah, blah, blah. We like, pfft. You know, frankly, I never thought Dave Brubeck could really play that well, to be honest with you. But, you know, that was like a really embarrassing. And then I saw these great musicians, Tom Varner, for example, who teaches here he's a blonde cat. He's a French horn player, fantastic musician. Left Oberlin for New England Conservatory. Bernadine Williams, he was some fantastic musician. Cheryl Freeman, I saw her on Broadway like three times. They left because the jazz department was so hard. And they had one professor. His name was Wendell Logan. And he was from Mississippi. And if you wanted to learn trumpet, jazz trumpet, you went to Wendell. If you wanted to learn jazz saxophone, trombone, composition. And he taught all those things. And his students loved him. And I was taking his jazz arranging and composition course. And this is the other thing. The professors there in the conservatory at that time, not now, but at that time, they really disliked Wendell because he was just because he was so stalwart in terms of what jazz was. And I witnessed this, and I was very bitter about it as a student. But Wendell was, you know, he was steady. He was always about the music. Stick to the music and don't look to the side. Stick to the music. If you're going to hate somebody, you're going to suck sorrow. Stick to the music. Just stick to the music. So I was taking his class, his arranging and composition class. And my best friend, Leander Bean, who's white, who's a pianist, he's a wonderful pianist. Leander and I took the midterm, and Leander got an A, and I got a C. So I waited till the class left. I waited till Leander left, and then I went up to Wendell, and I said, Professor Logan, I said, Leander got an A, and I got a C on the midterm. And he said, that's right. And I said, well, you know, I mean, I got a C, and, you know, what, you know, you and me. And he did one, and he looked at me, he went. He said, I gave Leander an A because he earned it. He said, I gave you a C, and you just earned a D. He said, don't you ever come in here and speak about anything less than the truth. I'm teaching you to stick to the music. This music is about the truth. Leander's about the truth. What are you about? You be about the truth. I never forgot that. Fast forward 20 years. I sat in the Finney Chapel at Oberlin and saw Stevie Wonder. I mean, they had a big concert where they opened up an $8 or $10 million jazz facility. Stevie Wonder did a concerto, and all they invited back maybe 20 or 25 of us to perform there with him, and they opened up this beautiful, beautiful beautiful jazz department. It's just fantastic. It's with the best in the country. And what I learned from it is the same lesson I learned from my mother. Stick to the truth. Be patient. Be honest. Just go for it. You will suffer now, but in the end, you know, you'll be the vine that Jesus walks on. You know, there was a wonderful phrase at Saint James, right in the front of the church, and it says, "I am the vine, and you are the branches." And I was looking at that today, and I was thinking to myself, there is a great disparity between the acts of man and the idealism of Jesus, and which vine do I want to be? And I think about that often. I was talking today about AIDS and how AIDS used to be and what happened in the 80s. Because a lot of my friends, many from Oberlin, they died from AIDS. And nobody said nothing, really. And these are white folks, not just black. These are white folks. And I was talking about the great Paul Minot, who wrote a book called Becoming a Man. And how that book, a gay friend of mine gave that to me, and how it changed my perspective. There are things happening right now that we don't pay attention to. That are happening, that are just flowing past us. And which of us is going to be the John Brown that says, excuse me a minute, I'm not sure I agree with that. Now, I'm not saying become a terrorist like him, but I am saying that there is a time when you have to stand up for something that really counts. And that time is every single day. It's not just on Martin Luther King's holiday or Gay Pride Day. It's every day, all the time. And if you do that, you lead a life of fulfillment and joy. And I like to think that I ask God every day the prayer that my mother taught me, which is, please let me be a blessing to somebody else. It has helped me so much in my life. And the reason why I think I'm a success, if there's a such thing as being a success, and success, by the way, is a very relative term. But I think the reason why my words have reached so many people is because I've asked God to help me. And he has helped me. And he's helped me reach you. And I hope that whatever I have said to you today will help you reach someone else.
Thank you so much for that. That was beautiful. So you write prolifically, and you're a journalist, fiction, nonfiction. I'd love to hear you talk about how the mediums are different for you, and what do you prefer? What do you love most?
Between the two?
Yeah.
Well, I prefer fiction because fiction lets your dreams come true. I think the difference between them is that fiction allows you to get closer to the truth. You can be more brutal in fiction about what is true and what is not. Mm. Whereas in nonfiction, you have to kind of, even if you're writing about events that happened long ago, you can't take the liberty of you can't take the license of stretching the boundaries of the moment to make it clear to the reader what is happening. I guess the best example would be that during slavery, when John Brown attacked Harper's Ferry, he was waiting for the black folks to show up. And, you know, that's like me waiting for the drummer in my band to come to rehearsal. I mean, you know, his car broke down and, you know, he couldn't catch the subway. And, you know, I mean, if I was a black guy in 1859, I wasn't going to show up neither. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, I'm glad you want to make us free and all, mister, but, you know, I think that's white folks' department that day, and I think I'll just leave it there. Because that's my way of absolving myself of the responsibility of taking care of my own future, because I'm just not a soldier. And how do you say that, you know, in nonfiction without it seeming like black people were you know, cowards? It's really quite complicated. They didn't know. John Brown left. He never did anything on time. The timing was off. And actually, more black people were there than we actually know. But it's easy to do it in a sort of tragic comic way, as I did in The Good Lord Bird, than to do it in a nonfiction way. Plus, I hate writing books that are depressing and, you know, take your medicine. You know, I hate those kinds of books.
Well, that's a perfect segue. Let's talk about humor. Lori Hartzell in the Star Tribune said that The Good Lord Bird was the funniest book you'll ever read about slavery. And she said The Color Water was the funniest book about abuse and poverty you will ever read. How did you come to use humor in your work?
Well, my family's we're pretty funny people, you know. I don't like too much serious stuff, you know. I'm trying to preserve my... Humor preserves my innocence. And you have to have innocence in order to be a good writer, I think. You have to... You must guard it judiciously. As I said earlier today, I was... One of the problems with the James Brown book, which is, you know, is coming out next year, is that it really, really pushed hard into my innocence department. Because so many bad things happen to so many good people for nothing. But basically, you have to preserve your innocence. And out of that comes the humor. Because, look, if an alien landed on Earth and saw how we treated each other, they would be shocked. You know? They just wouldn't believe it.
Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, John Brown, you take on historical figures in... humanize them in ways that are sometimes surprising, like with Frederick Douglass. Could you talk about what that process was like? And is there anyone that you would be intimidated, a historical figure you would not want to take on?
Well, old Fred. You know, I for those of you who haven't read the book, I have a chapter where I kind of make a little bit of fun of Frederick Douglass. He's basically gets fresh with Onion, and he thinks Onion's a girl, and they have a little too much to drink, and, you know, whack, and he starts getting... It was just so funny, I couldn't resist it, you know. But the truth is that Frederick Douglass and John Brown were good friends until John Brown attacked Harper's Ferry. I mean, John Brown wrote his plans to attack Harper's Ferry at Frederick Douglass's house. Frederick Douglass supported John Brown, but he was smart enough not to go on a suicide mission with John Brown. So when John Brown asked him, Frederick Douglass said, no, it's a steel trap, and I ain't going. And John Brown never mentioned Frederick Douglass's name ever again. And I had that fact in my head. It was a dramatic high point in your story. And, you know, when you arc out your story, you have these dramatic high points. And I knew I had to come to it some kind of way. And it just seemed too delicious to leave it out. And I've taken some criticism about my portrayal of Frederick Douglass in the book. But there are plenty of books that, you know, including by Frederick Douglass. First of all, Frederick Douglass speaks for himself very well on the page. And there are plenty of other books that... But I should point out that Frederick Douglass did have, in real life, a black wife and a white mistress, and they lived in the same house. Now, maybe y'all can do that in Seattle, but in Brooklyn, we just don't do that. So fiction allows you... Look, it's just like I was talking to a friend of mine when I first went to South Carolina to research the James Brown book. I went into this restaurant in this small town in South Carolina, man. South Carolina, they should just... If they carved that out and dropped it in the ocean, honestly, I wouldn't be too upset about it. But I mean, for those of you from South Carolina, I apologize. I mean, Dominus on E Pluribus, nice food, good peaches, good potato pie, and so forth. But I walked into this restaurant, and everybody looked like James Brown. I mean, everybody, you know, even the kid. And then I walked out, and then this guy walked in, and this two kids looked like James Brown. I was like, oh, shit. I can't put that in a nonfiction book. It just won't work. But and that was just in my own head. I mean, they all didn't look like James Brown, but several of them did. Anyway, so that's the difference between fiction and nonfiction.
Uh-huh.
You want to know the name of this restaurant? No, I ain't going to tell you.
Your books are so, even the works of fiction are meticulously researched. Could you talk some about what your research process is like?
I just go all the way out, you know, I go all the way with it. I read a lot of books, I visit the place, you know, I spend a lot of time there. You know, one of the things you learn as a journalist is that you research 100% of it and you only use 10% of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, when even with The Color of Water, I only used 10% of what I came up with. Because you have to know, you have to be really, you know, you have to really know your subject well, but you just know it well enough to lay in the pipeline what the story is. You know, you're digging a pipe into the ground. You part the earth, you drop the pipe, and you close up. You don't want to know where the other pipes are in the street. You want to build houses. I go deep. I whatever can get me to the mainland, however you need to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm. We have some questions from the audience. An audience member would like to know, have you learned any Yiddish?
Nine. No. No, I mean, I have a book of Yiddish proverbs, and I'm sorry that Yiddish is a disappearing language. There are some schools that have some Yiddish professors, but it's one of those parts of American life that is fast disappearing.
Another audience member would love to know, how does your upbringing and your mom's parenting influence you as a parent?
Well, I mean, I don't spank my kids. You know, my daughter's 22, I'm going to spank her, you know. No, I didn't spank my kids. I have a 22-year-old, 21-year-old, and they're both college students, and a 12-year-old. I try to be consistent with them. I try to take, now that I'm divorced, I take my 12-year-old to church, you know, and my ex-wife never really believed in church that much. And I have my issues with the Baptist church, really, lots of issues with them. I mean, I have tons of issues with the church, but the culture of it, just the culture of humility that you know, if you accept it for real, is a good thing. And also the music is a good thing. And also the kindness of the people is a good thing. I think part of the problem in American life is that the standard stereotype view of black people has become just totally bastardized by, you know, these filmmakers and these idiots. And either blacks are like punks who pull it, you know, I'll kick your ass. I mean, either that or they're big mama men, you know, like Eddie Murphy and these guys dressing like blacks. So black women always going, you go girl, and you know. Mm-hmm. And that's really, you know, to present black people in that way as one-dimensional characters to me is just an absolute disgrace. Mm-hmm. And so I take my children to church, and my older children will go to church with me, in part because they see a part of African-American life that I knew as a child. Well, you had people who were shy. You had people who were totally just different, unique. You know, there was a guy in our church who was a wonderful artist. It was a Winston. He used to ride by. He was riding bicycles when I was a kid. He was in total. I mean, you meet people who are just different. And you see the totality. What you really see is you see the kindness of African-American life. And I think that kindness of African-American life, if there are ties between African-American and Jews, which I don't think there are really, so, and we don't want to have that conversation. But if there are ties, the tie really is the ultimate kindness of the people themselves. And African-Americans are very, very kind people. And Jewish people, in my experience, when I'm just talking about Eastern European Jews from New York, are very, very kind people. Now, there's a whole lot of, sometimes you got to go through Sing Sing to get to the kindness. But when you get to it, it's real and it's deep and it's lifelong lasting.
Another audience member asked you to please talk about your transition from music at Oberlin to writing, and how do you feel music feeds your writing?
Well, I went to Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, and I think what music gives you is the discipline to know that you're going to fail. and that you're not the best, because there's always someone who's stronger. I mean, I've been knowing George Caldwell. My Oberlin friends remember George Caldwell was the greatest jazz pianist in my time at Oberlin, and I've known him for 25 years, and George, longer than that, and George has never called me for a job, ever. Not once. Bum. He's never called. Because my sound is not what George wants to hear. And I accept that. Mm-hmm. And so music teaches you not only the discipline of, you have to stay within a framework of, if you're working in the key of B flat, you better, if you play an F sharp, you better be Charlie Parker. But it also teaches you that within that framework, there are things that you can do that are slick. Mm-hmm. And that you can do in the writing game mm-hmm. as well. And that's where really research and the structure of learning to write as a journalist helped me tremendously. Mm-hmm. So in that way, they kind of work together.
Ah. There's actually a connected question from another audience member, which is, does your success bring you a sense of performance pressure? And how do you cope with this and keep the writing process healthy for you?
Well, I mean, first of all, I mean, success is a relative term, and I really mean it. I mean, I don't really... Most people who I meet, I don't even tell them I'm a writer. I just say I'm a saxophone player, and I just let them. And they say, "Well, you're playing." I say, "Oh, I'm not playing around. Well, I'm playing in Portland somewhere," and that ends it. And then I can see the real them. Mm. I forget everything I do instantly. I never read reviews. I never read stories about me. I have to stay. My job is to go to St. James and look and see two homeless people in there and two people in the church and the organist and figure out what the organist is playing and why he or she is playing it mm-hmm. and get a blessing at the same time mm-hmm. and walk out with that little verse that maybe will end up somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I don't think whatever I did before is gone, and whatever I do tomorrow looks to, again, to the commonality of the human experience. How can I send a message to, you know, to people who read that we are more alike than we are different?
Mm-hmm. One of the, speaking about that verse or the little things that you find, one of the things I loved in The Color of Water is all the omens who show up. And there's a passage where Annie's speaking to Onion about omens, and she says, good omens are important. They're not just like the good Lord Bird's feathers. They're not just feathers or passwords. They're omens. They're things you don't forget easily, even in times of trouble. I wondered, as John Brown like tries to get rid of talismans he's carrying, how do you feel about omens? And do you have any omens for your writing process?
American Spirit is the yellow pack. I just get to it. I don't mm-hmm. have any... I'm a little superstitious. Like, I walk into the room with the right foot first. Mm-hmm. Because my godfather used to say that if you walk into the room with the right... It's that old black thing. I see some of the black folk. You know, because God... Something about God... I can't remember how he would say it, but God... You want to be on the right hand of God, so if you walk into the room with the right foot first and you hold your right hand out, mm-hmm. God is smiling. So when I was at Oberlin, I would always walk into the room. If I was taking a test or something, I was always walking into the room with the right foot first. And now at my age, everything's right foot first. I just hop down the street on my right foot trying to make it. I'm hopping up hills on right foot. I mean, but I don't have a whole bunch of rituals or anything. I get up, I get to it, I get involved, you know.
Another audience member wants to know, what was the funniest or weirdest thing that happened to you at Oberlin?
I saw a guy named Probin Gregory win a beer drinking contest. And he was a little guy. He plays with the Beach Boys. He plays trumpet and guitar. He's a talented cat, you know. And he was a little guy, and he won a beer drinking contest. That was one of the fun. And then I went skinny dipping in the reservoir with a woman, you know. I mean, nobody, you know, when I was at Oberlin, I wasn't really, I mean... people who went to Oberlin don't even remember me because I didn't do anything of any significance. You know, I really wasn't like the best at anything. I was just basically hanging. I remember I wrote my godfather. Moses Hogan was my classmate. Moses Hogan was a deeply gifted pianist from New Orleans who died of AIDS. But he was the first person I met at Oberlin. I met him in the lobby of Dascom. And we were talking about music, and I said, I play jazz. I play saxophone from Brooklyn, blah, blah. And he said, well, I'm from New Orleans. He said, but I don't play jazz. And I said, you're from New Orleans, and you don't play jazz? He said, well, I said, let me play. So I went down to the piano. I said, well, I play a little jazz. I play a little jazz on the piano. I said, let me hear you play something. So he sat down. He played some Bach and, you know, a little Ravel. And I was like, yeah, that's a shame you don't play jazz. He said, well, I play a little jazz. I said, well, play some. And he busted out with some low-down, you know, stride piano, just some gorgeous jazz, flawless technique. And I went to my room, and I wrote a letter to my godfather, and I said, I ain't going to make it here. And he wrote me a letter back, and I'll never forget it, and I still have the letter. And he couldn't, my godfather was not a lettered man. He didn't read that well. He was a janitor for Long Island University in Brooklyn. He said, don't worry, put God first. I know you can make it. And he spelled the word no, N-O. And when he did that, it just touched my heart. I said, you know, he believes in me. I didn't drop out. But Oberlin was tough in those years. It was tough. You know, they had admitted a bunch of black students, and some of those professors were not that nice to us. Mm-hmm. But we just did the job. I was just talking to a class. Some people didn't make it. And I don't know if it was a function of racism, whatever, but there was a lot of pressure because the jazz students were really getting good. Mm-hmm. And music is a competitive field, mm-hmm. No matter what it is. Mm-hmm. So, but it worked out, and I have a very good relationship with Oberlin. My son goes to Oberlin. He's a bass major, mm-hmm. and he loves it, you know. And he could have gone to just about any music school. He just loves it there. And I'm so glad he's there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I wish they'd give him some money, but, you know.
We have time for just two more questions. One audience member would love to know, when was it that you knew that you wanted to become a writer?
I didn't know. It wasn't a conscious decision. I went to Columbia because I was socially active after Oberlin. You know, I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement at Oberlin, mm-hmm. to divest money from the school when no one knew who Nelson Mandela was. And all. I was really involved in that when I graduated, just before I graduated in 79. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to, that social activism that Oberlin inspired me, in me, helped me tremendously. And so when I got to Columbia, I just wanted to be a journalist to change things. Mm-hmm. I evolved into a writer over a period of about 9 or 10 years after leaving Columbia, when I went from one newspaper to the next. And creatively, newspapers were just not creative enough for me. The story, you know, you go out to cover a story, it was like a fire, you know, a 3-alarm fire destroyed a house on 32nd Street. And then you say, no, it really wasn't that. It was the landlord who didn't do the fire. And then the landlord couldn't afford to make that. And then the story just kept getting bigger and bigger. The fire marshal was supposed to inspect, but he couldn't make it because his car broke. I mean, you know, and so you just get into, like, the story just became bigger and bigger. And my desire to look at the bigger picture, journalism couldn't encompass that. And that's how I became a writer.
One thing that you said today that I'd love to ask you about, you said cynicism is toxic for a writer. How so?
Well, yeah, you know, skepticism is good, but cynicism is toxic because cynicism destroys your dreams. Cynicism is the thing that says to you, don't do it because it's been done before. I mean, jazz is really, I mean, music that's been done before all the time. Mm-hmm. But when Hank Mobley plays a solo, it's not the same as John Coltrane or Charlie Parker or Oliver Nelson. I mean, they all sing the same. Look, when Frank Sinatra sings Nice Work If You Can Get It, I don't care what you say. Can't nobody sing it like Frank Sinatra. You can get Michael Bublé all you want. You can Bublé this and Bublé that. He ain't Frank Sinatra. I mean, he's great. I like it. But he just ain't Frank.
Right.
That said, he's Michael Bublé. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had a name like Michael Bublé, I would just change that name. Really, I would just change it. I would call myself Mr. Bubble. You know, I would call myself Mr. Bubble, you know, on saxophone from Brooklyn, New York, Mr. Bubble. But anyway, what was the question?
You were talking about the cynicism and how it undermines writing.
You can't be cynical. You have to, because cynicism makes you say, that's been done before, mm-hmm. and you can't do it, you know. I mean, it's nice that people make comparisons to Mark Twain when they talk about the good Lord Burke, but let's just be clear here. That ain't Mark Twain. Mark Twain is Mark Twain. Toni Morrison is Toni Morrison. The rest of us have to take the subway and wait in the cold for the bus. They fly. but the notion that you can't do something because it's been done before is a terrible thing, especially to tell to young artists and to young writers. They must know that their voice is special and unique. And if you have to tell a kid for 30 years, I am special, so are you, then fine. But cynicism will make you say, that can't happen. I can't stand when I don't have a TV, but when I had a TV, I would see people get on television, they say, well, we can't stop guns. It's not going to happen. So blah, 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 you know. And I would just say to myself, that person is a failure, you know, because we can stop guns. You're going to tell me you got 30 kids that get killed in Newtown, Connecticut, and people pull out their pea shooters in their hand, drop the hammer on, and we can't stop the NRA from taking these guns off the street. We can do anything we want. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can. Mm-hmm. So to say that it's never going to happen or that can't happen is just toxic. I mean, that's just that's not how America was built. Mm-hmm. You know, they told Martin Luther King, you can't do it. Well, he did it. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I went to Jackson, Mississippi for the 50th anniversary, and I'm probably a few people, maybe people from Seattle were there, and I was inspired. When I'm doing a TV show with David Simon, who's the guy who did The Wire, and he's doing Parting the Waters as a TV series in 2016, and mm-hmm. I'm one of the writers for it, and so I went down there to, just because they had the 50th anniversary of the civil rights voter registration workers in Jackson, Mississippi. I'm not talking about the Freedom Riders. I'm talking about the people who went with the sharecroppers down to the courthouse to register every day and got their asses kicked, and then they would come back the next day and the next day and the next day. And a lot of those people were sharecroppers and white college kids from Carleton College and Oberlin College and Seattle, places like who came to, and a lot of them came back. And it was inspiring to see these people. And I wish more people could see what their fellow Americans look like, because these people were 60 and 70 years old. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about what they went through as young people. And I said to myself, what a gift God gave them. Mm-hmm. The courage to go down there at that time, to stand arm in arm with people that they didn't know, to struggle for something, and then the gift of life to live long enough to come back to see old friends and to say, yes, I was here when it happened. Mm-hmm. And you should have seen some of the kids that talked to them, some of the black kids who came up to them and were talking to them. It was just, it was absolutely inspiring. Mm-hmm. And I get out of bed to see stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That the prayer on my lips every night is that people will see that, because we are capable of great things. Those people were not cynics. They were young, idealistic people who went to the South to fight with people who demonstrated enormous courage, and the courage they learned from those sharecroppers and those workers who wanted to vote gave them the inspiration to live lives of quality, learning, labor, and excellence. So cynicism is toxic. Yeah.
Well, I can't imagine a better place to end. Please join me in thanking James McBride.
Thanks for finding your way over to this podcast of Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you appreciate the series, please give us a good review. It helps more people find us. James McBride's books include The Color of Water, Miracle at St. Anna, Song Yet Sung, and The Good Lord Bird, for which he won the National Book Award. McBride is currently a distinguished writer in residence at New York University. Seattle Arts and Lectures presented this talk at Town Hall Seattle on October 15, 2014. The presenting sponsor was the Seattle Times. Thanks to Ruth Dickey and the staff at Seattle Arts and Lectures for this recording. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien. God.